Yeah. Well, good morning. My name's Michael Theophilus, and today the Bible study will be on the Lucan infancy narrative. Last week, of course, we heard from Sharon on the infancy narrative in Matthew. Now we're looking at Luke, being the other gospel, of course, that includes the infancy narrative. So basically, we're going to try and cover two chapters in about an hour or 50 minutes, which is, of course, absolutely impossible task. 5 years ago, when I finished my PhD, I was overjoyed that I was able to complete this project on three words from the Gospel of Matthew. So the prospect of covering two chapters in 1 hour isn't very realistic, to say the very least. You should have a handout in front of you. If you don't, there's more here. And also a rough sort of view of the screen. There'll be some things that we talk about. I like to reward people for being punctual, and you're punctual. So the reward for being punctual this morning is that you get to see a depiction of the infancy narrative from the second oldest Jesus movie ever produced. No. The advent of cinema occurred at the very tail end of the 19th century, and in 1905 a film was produced called The Passion, The Life and Passion of Jesus Christ. And I'm just going to show you a clip of about 40...
That was Gibson, or, right?
No. No. Here we go. Depictions of Christ in cinematography, which is a topic unto itself. But we'll talk more about that episode in a few moments. But what I thought would be good, just by way of introduction, is just to see, sorry, this is a bit skewed, but you get the general picture. This is a graph which basically shows you throughout Luke and then in Acts some of the terminology that's used. And I've plotted here, the red is in. The red depicts the instances of Jesus, and Christ is in blue. And what you see is gradually throughout the narrative, there's a shift from the writer, Luke, talking about Jesus, this figure, first of all by his personal name, and then moving more and more with greater frequency in Acts, especially with this person being identified as the Christ, which is obviously sort of key punchline of the whole narrative. If you do this across the New Testament, don't worry, the whole presentation is going to be all these graphs and whatever. We're going to get to the Bible in a sec. But you do this across the whole New Testament, and again, the red is Jesus, Christos is in blue, and then the combination of the two are in green. So there's even, you can see in the Gospel in particular, that there's a lack of that. And that gradually develops as we go through. But let me start by giving you a basic summary of the Lucan story, or the infancy narrative, basically, if you were to pick up a sampling of 1,000 Christmas cards, okay, that you send and receive. This is basically how it goes. On the evening of December 25th, 2012, years ago, Mary rode into Bethlehem on a donkey, urgently needing to give birth to her baby. Although it was an emergency, all the public innkeepers turned Mary and Joseph away, so Jesus was born in a stable. Angels sung to the shepherds, and they joined the three kings, Jasper, Melchior, and Belshazzar, who ride in on camels and worship Jesus, who sleeps peacefully on the hay. And now that's all very good. If you're a Hallmark card company making these things to distribute for us to buy. But the problem with that is that almost every item in that description is incorrect, or at least unknown when you look at the infancy narratives of Matthew and Luke. Not the 25th of December. Well, I guess there's a 1 in 365 chance. It's definitely not the year zero, because that year didn't actually exist, according to the person who created the calendar. It's not a quiet baby, necessarily. We're not told that it was urgent for Mary. It's not as if, you know, Mary comes riding into Bethlehem on a donkey and then she sort of gives birth half an hour later. And when the time was fulfilled, she gave birth. So maybe a day, maybe 3 weeks, we don't know. We're not told that it's an inn, not a stable, and all these other things. They're not kings. We three kings of Orient, etc. Not kings. They're magicians, astrologers, astronomers. These categories have collapsed. So the thing that really troubles me at Christmas time, maybe less so in this part of the world, I'm from Australia, the thing that really troubles me about Christmas time in Australia is this hallmark Christmas card approach to understanding the infancy narratives of, you know, Christmas is a time of love, joy and peace. Well, yes, but at least in the first instance it wasn't that. It was a time of uncertainty, of fear, of pregnancy out of wedlock, a time of bizarre appearances of angels and the like. And I think the infancy narratives of both Matthew, but especially Luke, the main punchline in all of this is that God can work in those deeply distressing, uncertain times and bring about the climax of his covenant. So, let's turn you... On the handout you'll see here, underneath the graph there, Septuagintisms and the world of the Old Testament. What's really interesting, and I'm not going to subject you to having to read through these two chapters because they're very long. When you move from chapter 1, verse 4, which is the introduction to... Who's Luke writing to? Mr. Theophile. That's right. Most excellent Theophilus.
Is that you?
Well, no, I wish. So he's writing to his patron, probably, Theophilus. And the style of the language in those first four verses are highly polished. It has all the elements of what you'd expect of good classical Greek literature. When you move then to verse 5 following, you move into a completely different world. You move into a world where... And I've got a couple of these points here. You have this repeated phrase, it came to pass, eyenetho, which of course comes straight out of the Septuagint version of the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, where you have the corresponding Hebrew for that. So you've got, of course... Luke 2:1, Luke 2:6, Luke 2:15, and etc. So that obviously, eyenetho in the Septuagint corresponds to vaito, and it came to pass. Another minor point, and this is, I'm not saying this to convolute the discussion of the Bible study, but you also have future indicatives used as imperatives, and all that I mean by that. This is a very common way of expression in the Septuagint, and Luke seems to employ these Semitic ways of rendering his Greek. And the thing you note as you read through this, you go from very formal classical style of Greek into this different world, and I think he does that for a reason. He does that to introduce us into the world, literally a different world, to transport us back into the world of a... transports the reader into another world, the stylistic world of the Old Testament. Because as you'll see as we go through, there are myriads of connections with the Hebrew scriptures, with Luke's infancy narrative. Just before we look at some of those, I want to show you this papyrus manuscript. Part of my work at the university has to do with working with papyri. And here's one, Papyrus 299. And this is the birth announcement. And in the in the ancient world, birth announcements were pretty common. We have dozens of examples of people's births being announced on papyrus in different contexts. So this is one such birth pronouncement preserved on this manuscript from the year 49 to 50 AD, so smack bang in the centre of the first century. And it basically says, I think I've given you the translation, well, and the Greek if you want to have a look at that. But it basically announces the birth of this person, and it's asking that this birth be registered officially with the people, with the secretary, basically, of that particular village. So that's just to show you that what we have in the scriptures here isn't necessarily anything unusual for the Greco-Roman world. You commonly have birth announcements made in literature of not just significant figures, but sort of this administrative side of the Greco-Roman world. So what we get then in the first section, and I've listed these out for you because there's so much material just in paragraph forms, from chapter 1 verses 5 to 25 we get the birth of John the Baptist. In verse 5 it talks about Herod, of course, as Sharon last week mentioned to us. Herod, of course, is Herod the Great. He rules Palestine from 37 to 4 BC. And there's two things that Herod is known for. What are they?
Killing people that he likes.
His brutality to his enemies. Exactly those two things. Paranoia, and so his brutality towards other people, and also his massive building program. You only have to wander around this very city to see that. Well, not up here, but down the hill a little bit to get a sense of that. We're introduced to a priest called Zechariah, who belongs to the priestly division of Abijah in 1:5. Now, as you would know, 1 Chronicles 24, we don't have to read that, but you might just want to make a brief note of that. 1 Chronicles 24, verses 1 to 19. The priesthood in Israel, of course, divided into 24 courses, and each providing a temple service for a portion of the year. And we're told that Abijah is the 8th division of the priesthood in verse 10 of 1 Chronicles 24. Verse 7, we're introduced to something of real interest, and that is that Elizabeth was barren. Now, of course, if you've read even a cursory glance at the Hebrew scriptures, and you'll know that this is a very significant theme, especially in the book of Genesis. What you have to set this in the context of course, is that family life was really based on inheritance. If you didn't have kids, you effectively were extinguished. There was nothing more of you to go on. So the primary social unit is the family, and ancestry was, of course, of significance. And we explored that even last week with the genealogy, or the week before with the genealogies. And of course, not having a child was shameful. You read in let me give you some examples. I mean, obviously, who were some of the people that are childless in the Hebrew scriptures? Very famously,
Sarah
in Genesis 18, or even Sarai in Genesis 11. That she's introduced. The first thing we find out about her is what?
She's
barren. That's not very good. Obviously, Rebecca in 25:21, Rachel in chapter 30, even the unnamed mother of Samson, that's right, in Judges 13. Hannah, in 1 Samuel 1. I think, though, Sarah probably provides the closest analogy to Elizabeth, since she's not only called barren, but one other thing. Yeah, past childbearing age, which is a strong connection there with Elizabeth. But in all those cases, and in this case with John the Baptist, and, of course, with the birth of Jesus leading up to that, the thematic presence of this childlessness provides a context for God to show his grace and power. We're told in verse 9, reading on, to go into the temple of the Lord to burn incense. There's some interesting things you could do here on word studies for what word is used for temple, naos, here, as opposed to ieron,
etc. We don't need to bother ourselves too much with that. But as you know, the high priest goes into the temple just once a year on the Day of Atonement. But incense is offered daily, before the morning sacrifice and after the evening sacrifice. And this is obviously a hugely significant event in someone's life. And you assume, although there's, I'm not sure of any ancient evidence to corroborate this assumption, but you assume that a priest really had this privilege of serving in that capacity in terms of their offering incense, sort of maybe once in his lifetime. And so it was a really special occasion for Zechariah to be serving in this capacity. And of course, when he's in there, verse 11, the angel of the Lord appears. Visions and messages, of course, are very common in the temple. I mean, there's a classic example of that in the prophets. You're thinking of who in particular? A vision in the temple. Yeah, Isaiah 6, the great vision there, and his call. But also 1 Samuel 3, Zechariah 3. Josephus describes how the Maccabean king and high priest John Hyrcanus, while offering incense in the temple, heard a heavenly voice telling him his sons had just won the victory in battle. And that's, we learn of that in Josephus in the Book of Antiquities.
Where is it?
In Josephus, Antiquities 13:10-3. Yeah. The angel of the Lord, of course, a very common motif. There's some ambiguity in the Old Testament, often whether it's actually God himself or a pre-incarnate Christ or an angel or whatever it might be. But here, where it's explicitly, we're told that it's Gabriel in verse 19. What's Zechariah's response? As all responses are when you encounter an angel. Fear. Fear. And that's why it's, you know, this Christmas card approach, when you've got these chubby little infants with wings coming off of that, the cherubim. That is nothing like a cherubim.
It is pretty fearful.
Yeah, yeah, well, maybe. Yeah. But, you know, every encounter, when people wet their pants, basically, when they encounter this divine being, or not sort of divine, but a heavenly being. And so his response is typical of the Old Testament figures. Look at the reaction of Gideon in Judges 6, or Manoah in Judges 13. Daniel in Daniel 8. You know, this is a common response, and it's an appropriate response because it's a terrifying experience, at least according to the stories we have in the Scriptures. And that's why you often get this this word of comfort. What is it? Don't be afraid. Fear not. Why? Well, because presumably there is terrified, literally shaking. Then the announcement in verse 13 is, of course, your wife will bear you a son. And, of course, predictions of birth of special children in the Old Testament are very common. You only have to look at Ishmael in Genesis 16, Isaac in Genesis 17, immediately after Samson, and then Emmanuel in Isaiah 7. What's going on in verse 15? Can someone read verse 15 for me? Luke 1:15.
He will be great in the sight of the Lord. He shall drink neither wine nor strong drink. He will also be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb.
The wine or fermented or strong drink. So the Greek word here, sikera, can mean any alcoholic beverage normally not made from grapes, so beer or something like that. And obviously the abstinence from alcohol sounds like it's some kind of Nazirite vow, which is undertaken for a specific period of consecration. But this wasn't just something to be undertaken for a limited period of time. It was for his life. Verse 15, it says he'll be filled with the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, even from birth. Again, normally in the Old Testament, the Spirit comes for a limited time for a particular purpose. Here it looks a little bit different. I'll show you another papyrus manuscript where it looks as if it's not just talking about human spirit, small s, but capital S, because of the sacred abbreviation that the scribe makes in a manuscript I'll show you in a short while. Then you've got in verses, moving on to the next main section, verse 26 to 38, the birth of Jesus, of course, foretold. It's interesting to note in verse 26, if you have a look at verse 26, we're told incidental detail, it might seem. We're told that this occurs at what time? In the 6th month. The 6th month, of course, of what? Of Caesar's reign? No. Of Herod's something or other? No. This is the 6th month of Elizabeth's pregnancy. And what that does, it's a connector to say, hey, don't forget that story you've just heard about with the birth of John, or with the announcement to Zechariah and Elizabeth. This story that follows is integrally connected to the one that has just been that's just been told. Reference to Nazareth in verse 26 as well. Of course, you've got a famous verse in John's Gospel which may illuminate sort of the disdain towards Nazareth. Can anything good come from Nazareth? In John 1:46. And it might surprise you that, or maybe it won't, surprise you that Nazareth isn't mentioned in many ancient sources. In fact, no ancient sources outside the Bible. And people were very sceptical about that. And there was an inscription found in the late 70s, I think, or 60s, late 70s maybe, with Nazareth. And then people were sort of think, oh, well, it must have existed because we have this one incidental inscription. It's like, well, there are other references to this in the Bible, but apparently that doesn't count for a lot. Yeah, exactly. So let's have a look here. Verse 27. We're told that it's a parthenon. Now, we looked at that word yesterday in the Hebrew from Isaiah 7:14, alma, and what that could possibly mean. Last week in terms of the similar quotation. And I think it's important to note, just tangentially, that although there are significant differences between Matthew and Luke, there are some things that actually are very similar. People like to emphasise, rightly so, that Matthew and Luke are writing a distinct story here and weaving the threads together differently. But the announcement to Mary is identical, verbatim. You've got the angel, you've got the annunciation, and some other elements which are very, very similar. So I wouldn't want to say that say that they're too different, although they're doing different things. Verse 27, we're also told that Joseph is a descendant of David, literally from the house of David, connecting his ancestry with the divinic line. And this, of course, means that Jesus is the legitimate heir to the throne of David. let's have a look. There's a couple of interesting phrases in verse 32. We're told, verse 32, this is in the Most High and Lord God. Most High, Lord God, these are basically Greek translations of Old Testament names for God. What's the Hebrew for Most High? The God Most High, El Elyon. And we find that in all sorts of places. I have some references in my other notes, but Genesis, I think there's a couple of references, and in other sections. But also, Lord God, obviously, is Yahweh Elohim, Yahweh God, which appears very frequently in the scriptures as well. The throne of David in verse 32 and 33, what it does, of course, is put centre stage the covenant made between David and God in 2 Samuel 7, and also referenced in Psalm 89, where David was promised that God would raise up a seed after him. And then there's this perplexed sort of question in verse 34, which is sort of fair enough. Can someone read 34 for us?
Verse 34
supposed to be Mary ask the angel since I'm a virgin?
Yeah. So you're going to give birth to this son, etc., etc., and then her response is, I'm a virgin. What is striking about that in terms of, we talked about before in verse 26, there's this linking connection between this pericope and the one before. Mm-hmm. What happens in the pericope before that might be related to this particular verse?
Well, she's too old. These are two kind of crazy miracles. One where the person's too old.
Mm-hmm.
And is that, I don't know what you're thinking of, but that's...
In particular, the question that's asked. I mean, what happens to Zechariah?
He says, I'm not sure. How can I be sure?
For a sign.
Exactly. He asks for a sign. How can I know that this will occur?
Yeah.
Now, what does Mary say? How can this be? And you might say, well, why was Zechariah struck dumb and Mary is sort of praised as this great... why are those two responses different? Aren't they the same thing?
No.
Well, how are they different?
Well, one's to the future, how can it be? And Mary's reaction is, so that's come to me, it's happening now.
Yeah, I think that's along the right track. I mean, and certainly, basically, Mary is asking how these words are going to come to pass. Zechariah is asking, how can he know that they will come to pass? So the difference is, yes, I've accepted it now, how is this going to all pan out? As opposed to Zechariah's response, which is perhaps not as, esteemed or faithful.
Let me throw in 2 cents from this. Yeah, the thoughts from Claire Fawn, which may be complimentary, maybe slightly different, but might also be complimentary. She was just the same thing that you're saying about how Zechariah is a priest once in his life, perhaps maybe twice, goes to the temple. He has this epiphany while he's there in front of the altar. There's any time in his life where he should be believing.
Mm.
This is the opportunity. Whereas here, she's very young. She hasn't. It's not like this is some kind of climactic experience in her life.
Mm.
It's very sort of off the cuff in a way. Mm. So there could be some kind of difference there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that would serve to contrast and highlight that juxtaposition between angelic appearance and then human response, one which is dubious at best and the other one which is sort of is overwhelmingly good. Now, verse 35, I've got a parallel here I want to show you from some ancient literature and then talk about what this Holy Spirit coming upon you might be. Overshadow you. It's interesting that the verb come upon is used similarly in the Septuagint of Isaiah 32, which refers to the Spirit coming upon the land to make it what? Fertile again. Luke uses the same verb in Acts 1, verse 8, of the Spirit's coming upon believers at Pentecost. And also the verb to overshadow is what we find in Exodus for the with reference of God's presence, His Shekinah overshadowing the tabernacle in the cloud. So it's interesting that in the past parallels with ancient pagan literature have attempted to be made in regard to the deity having intercourse with the human, then producing a hybrid offspring. I've got one of these here for you. This is a text from Diodorus Siculus from the Library of History, Book 4. And let's have a read. I don't know if anyone can read it from where they are, but would anyone like to have a shot of reading that?
Sure. Alcmene is deceived by Zeus, has intercourse with him, and produces Heracles. For when Zeus lay with Alcmene, he made the night 3 times his normal length. He did not affect this union from the desire of love, as he did in the case of other women, but rather only for the sake of procreation. Consequently, desiring to give legality to his embraces, he did not choose to offer violence to Alcmene, and yet he could not hope to persuade her because of her chastity, and so deciding to use deception, he deceived Alcmene by assuming in every respect the shape of Amphitmene.
So this, there's lots of these. It's not as if we don't know that there are gods in the pagan world trying to have intercourse with human beings. But the point of difference here in this narrative is that there's no hint of sexual union. It is the Holy Spirit coming, overshadowing you, functioning in a similar way to the sense in, say, the Septuagint in Isaiah, the same sort of words, bringing fertility to a barren or an un, unfertilized area. And that's the point. So these kinds of Greco-Roman parallels, which are very common in terms of discussions of this in the ancient world, don't really provide an appropriate parallel to this story. This is quite a unique kind of experience.
There's also no deception, and there's also a willing part on the human side.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah,
and then that's very clear. He couldn't do it otherwise, except for deception. And here it's being announced in broad daylight.
So again, this is an interesting contrast. Verse 35. I want to spend a little bit of time on this because Jordash and Sharon and others have mentioned this in Bible studies in the past. But have a look at verse 35, chapter 1. And he'll be called, what, at the end of the verse? Son of God. Now, Son of God, this is my students back in Australia sometimes have trouble conceiving this, but Son of God is effectively a human title. Son of Man, I would argue, has all the key note elements of divinity to it, because of its background in Daniel 7 and elsewhere in Ugaritic literature and the way it's used in the Psalms and, not that phrase, but related to Daniel, that's another discussion. Let me tell you why I think Son of God is a human figure. Even from Qumran, what do we have? We have evidence of this stuff functioning in this way. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that he will make your house. This is 4Q174. Make your house, and that I will raise up your offspring after you establish the throne of his kingdom. Forever will be a father to him. This is talking with regard to what? Davidic covenant, son of David, and will be a father to him. So, son, and he will be my son. So, son of God. 1Q SA2. Again, when God has fathered the Messiah. So, there's this idea that the Messiah, of course, of Qumran is human. It's not divine. So, again, this is going towards this idea of sonship. In this sense, divine sonship. Is for the king, connected to the covenant in 2 Samuel 7. What that provides is a really fascinating contrast with the Roman world, because when you look at, say, the coinage of...
Nice slide.
I'll cover that. Can't see that now. Who's this a coin of? What's this? What are these two letters? T-I. What's an emperor? No, that might be an abbreviation for?
Yeah,
Tiberius. And who is he?
Caesar.
Divine.
Of the divine Augustus.
Tiberius Caesar, divine Augustus. What's a very common... Phibius, son of Augustus. Uh-huh. What we have with... this is in Latin. I've got a Greek inscription in a minute that will show you the word son of God used for Augustus. But even in the iconography of the numismatic record, we have the emperors describing themselves as son of the divine one, the divine one. And that's also true. I mean, you look at the way Mark starts his gospel. He starts off by saying, there's a textual variant there, but presumably the son of God is included in verse 1. Let me show you this, because this is a pretty cool inscription.
Nice.
This one here... is an inscription from a marble inscription from Pergamum, again contributing to this idea of the sort of propaganda of the Roman emperor. It's a pedestal from bears an inscription of Augustus. Here's the actual inscription, or a trace of the actual inscription. Here's what text remains. It's a Greek, obviously, in the second line. Here it's restored to what we think it would have said, because we have other inscriptions and we can put all the letters in. And here's the English in green. So if you've got Greek, you can read this. Caesara Theo Yun Theo Sebastian. Excuse me. The Emperor Caesar, son of, well, we don't know, a god, but presumably a son of God, son of a god, the god Augustus, of every land and sea, the overseer.
Oh, I don't want to read. Stupid, but yeah. I think I lost you. So the expression "Son of God"
yes
actually refers to Jesus' humanity.
Well, I would argue that. Jesus' humanity insofar as it's a reference to his a Davidic kingly title, just like Psalm 2,
right.
Verse 7.
Right. And Son of Man...
Son of Man, I probably shouldn't open that can of worms, but I think Son of Man, when it talks about the Son of Man in Daniel, what's the primary category that the Son of Man... What activity does the Son of Man do in Daniel 7? But how does he do that?
Coming on the clouds.
That is riding the clouds is, if we read from the Ugaritic Baal cycle, this is what Baal does. He rides on the clouds. He's the cloud surfer. That language is picked up in the Psalms for Yahweh being the cloud rider. And this is then the imagery, I think, behind Daniel 7 of being the... So basically what I think Israel does is it's in the vicinity of Rosh Shamra or ancient Ugarit. These people refer to their god as the one who rides the clouds, Baal. They then adopt similar sort of language to say, no, your god isn't in charge of the clouds. Our god is actually the cloud rider. That's picked up in the Psalms. That transfers to Daniel 7. And then that's why when Jesus responds in Mark 14 to the high priest... with Daniel 7, what's their response? That you've blasphemed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's probably how I'd see that. But the point I'm making here is that the Son of God reference is embedded in this Roman propaganda of the Augustus, of the Caesar. And we see that from coinage and from other places. And what is interesting with that whole process is that this puts Christians, of course, on a path of conflict with the Roman Empire. Because if Caesar is Son of God, and then this proclamation goes out and says, no, he's not the true Son of God, Jesus Christ is the Son of God. This puts Christians on a collision course. This is questioning Roman supremacy. And Rome can always incorporate another god. They've got a pantheon of all sorts of funny gods from different nations, that are Greek gods, Parthian, whatever. One more god won't do any damage to their facade of control and power. The thing that Rome can't manage, can't deal with, is when their authority, their supreme authority, is challenged. And this text does that very thing. And in the Magnificat in particular... We'll get to in a moment. We'll have to speed it up a bit. In verse 52, 53, he has brought down rulers. He has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry. He sent the rich away empty. This is a direct confrontation with Rome. And you read the some Roman material, something like Tacitus, Suetonius. What happens to Christians in the early stages of the story? This is Tacitus writing. This is a Roman. This is not a Christian lamenting his brothers that have suffered exquisite tortures. What do they suffer? Mockery. They're torn apart. This is Christians. Torn apart by dogs. Nailed to crosses. Burnt. They serve... Check this out. This baffles my mind. They serve as nightly illumination for Nero's garden parties. Tarred. Set alight. With a stake in the ground. Now we can see and we can eat our food. This is our Christian brothers and sisters. This is what happens with a story like this.
You think the sound effects would give you your appetite?
You'd think so. And it's interesting, the response then of the greater Roman populace is not just... there arose a feeling of compassion. This is from pagans. Seeing the way in which Christians face their persecutors with such dignity and resolve. This is what this story does. This isn't just a story about happy snowmen, you know, melting away with a carrot in their nose. This is a polemic story that is directly confronting the Roman world. Not just in the titulature of Son of God, but in the story and the force behind the momentum of the story, which is he has brought the rulers down, the humble he has raised up. This theme of reversal in Luke's gospel is very common.
Beautiful.
And that's the essence of the essence of the Christian story, is that very thing. So then we flip back in verse 57 to the birth of John the Baptist in 57 to 66. And I'll just say one point here. No, I won't. We all know the kids are circumcised on the eighth day, so that's all really to mention there. Genesis 17. Just so you know, with regard to circumcision, Jews weren't the only ones to practice circumcision. There are lots of people. There are Egyptian inscriptions carved into limestone of them circumcising male adults, not infants, which maybe is an interesting parallel. So that might be an area that would be interesting to explore. Then you have Zechariah's song in verse 67 to 80. This is known as the Benedictus, which is a Latin for blessed. And you've got this reference to the horn of salvation. The horn indicates a powerful animal, and salvation, of course, presumably the task that that horn, that leader, that symbol of strength will achieve. I just want to show you in verse 80 this really interesting thing with the manuscripts. What have we got? Can someone read for us Luke 1, verse 80?
Oh, you can't really see that.
Sure.
Thanks.
The child grew and became strong in spirit, and he was in the wilderness until the day he appeared publicly to Israel.
Now, what is that, NRSV or?
That is, I believe, the NRSV. Just a sec.
Just in your version, check whether what case is the first letter of spirit. And just tell me the version that you're using. Lowercase in what version?
The English
version. ESV. Small for ESV.
Lowercase.
New King James is lowercase.
Small.
NIV small.
New King James small.
New King James small. Anyone got a capital? Oh, normally there's a couple of versions that have capital. I forget now which ones. But what's interesting is this is a manuscript. You can't see it there. It's better on my screen. Let me enlarge it. Maybe that will help. This is a manuscript. It's papyrus number 4 of the New Testament manuscripts. And what we have at this point in the manuscript is a nomina sacra. Nomina sacra is the sacred abbreviation of special names. So Jesus, Christ, God, Son of God, Jerusalem. Some names, as scribes writing this down in the 3rd, 4th, 5th, etc. centuries, undergo abbreviation. And on your handouts on the top right,
yeah.
It's a bit tricky to see there. Let me enlarge this even more. But can you see
the
where a pilot, a pi, a nu, and a yota, PNI, with the bar over the top?
That bar is hard to believe. You're going to push us for that?
On the...
I'm just kidding.
Just above the...
It's over the yota.
You can see it over the yota in particular. But this is the abbreviation for a spirit. But you only abbreviate spirit like this if you're referring to the Holy Spirit. So at least according to a scribe in the 4th century, their opinion of the Spirit's role here was the Holy Spirit, which is not definitive for the interpretation of a first century text, but at least shows you at least a Christian in an earlier, or a scribe in an earlier period, interpreted this slightly different to the way that we've got in our English versions. And of course, it's always dangerous to simply go off one English version or any English versions. You want to get back to the original languages, of course, which is what you guys do in this church more than any other church I've ever been to, which is refreshing and wonderful and encouraging for me as well. Let me just talk about one thing in particular. Oh, here's... This is Washingtonius. Let me show you the section here. Here you can clearly see this is 5th century
Dokumenta.
And following. So again, this scribe has abbreviated that in verse 180 because they think that it's they think that's necessary or the reference there. I want to mention just one historical conundrum that we have in these two chapters, and this is a reference to a census of the Roman world in 2:2. A census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This is deeply problematic for historians because, and it's also one of the most disputed historical remarks in Luke. Josephus, in Antiquities, Book 18, 1.1, refers to a census in 6 AD. Okay, this is too late. because Herod the Great's already dead by this point, and Jesus was born when Herod the Great was alive. He died in 4 BC. So he's at least, well, he's about 10 years off, it seems. It's too late for that setting. There have basically been three responses to that in terms of possibilities of how Luke might be functioning here with regard to, well, four, I guess, if you say Josephus was wrong, but you know, people don't normally take that option. Three main responses. One possibility here is that a census would have been a massive undertaking. We recently had a census in Australia, and with all the whiz-bang kinds of things with technology, that involved still someone coming to your door to interview you and to take notes, etc. It's a massive undertaking, and it could have started under one ruler, emerged under another ruler, say when Quirinius is governor of Syria, and that would be a possible explanation of the conundrum of the date being slightly different.
So it started at 4 BC.
Yeah, exactly. So it's taking, I mean, that's a little bit long to take a census, but some people have said, well, a census doesn't happen just with the pressing of a button and everyone emailing back their responses. In a world like that, it's much more complicated. That's one possibility if you want to take that route. A second possibility is that Quirinius, who became governor in Syria for the later census, may have been merely an administrator for the census, and the Greek word there simply means ruler. It doesn't have a technical force, so he could have just it could have been contrasting him being ruler as opposed to governor of Syria. So if you want to take that route. But what's interesting is this textual variant that we have. The difference between this was the first registration and this registration occurred before Quirinius was governor of Syria. And in the manuscripts Aleph and D, you have this particular reading, which would then alleviate that problem, because it's not when he was, it occurred before he was. And in the manuscript, and I've got this printed for you on the left hand side of halfway down.
Okay.
Can you see Afti, so starting here, Afti
Aften. Αυτήν απογραφήν.
Α, yeah, sorry, right. Απογραφήν εγένε το πρώτη ηγεμονευόντος της Συρία. Now, what you note here, you see these little lines above, 2, 1 and 3?
Yeah.
The original scribe wrote it as it is, as we find in the text. A secondary scribe has come and said, no, that's not right. Actually, the order of the words should be 2, 1, 3. That is, this one first, that one second, that one third, which is the difference between this was the first registration and this was the registration which occurred before.
Which manuscript is this?
That's the Sinaiticus.
Is it?
Yeah. So 4th century. So ancient scribes are wrestling with that, not just modern ones, modern commentators. But there are a couple of different options there, and you might not find either of those satisfying, which is okay, you can do your PhD on it or something, and solve the riddle.
Are they doing that with historical consciousness, or is this an issue of syntax and grammar? What is the issue? Do they know another manuscript?
I think they're doing it because there's this, you know, there's no record of a census during that time, so they're trying to alleviate the historical conundrum, the historical creeks.
So they're aware of
that. I think so. Mm-hmm. Because in later manuscripts, you also get the same change. So in D as well, 100 years later, people trying to iron out this sort of historical difficulty in the manuscript. If you don't take one or two of those options.
So basically the corrector of this manuscript is just saying the way you should understand this.
Yes.
Because you can understand it the same way the first way it's written. Apte apografe. Prote hegemonevonos tesurias. Just because it's fronted in part of the verb, you could still understand
it.
Yeah.
But that way it would certainly
make it clear.
Accentuate that element.
Right.
Now, just by way of a couple of points, and then we'll sort of wrap it up. I want to show you one more papyrus manuscript, and I've got it for you written with transcription translation in the bottom left-hand corner of the page. What's the one thing, and this is obviously very clear, this is the central part of the Christmas story, what's the one thing that Joseph and Mary have to do when the census has been taken?
Register.
Yeah, in there. Yeah, right, so they travelled 140 kilometres or something, depending whether they went through Samaria or around, we don't know. But they had to go back to their hometown. Now the problem with that, and this is another context where people become very concerned about historical practices, is that there's no evidence that you had to do that if you're, you know, for a Roman census. And so people say, this is just a literary ploy to get Jesus back to Bethlehem with the connection to David and the Davidic line, etc. But it's fanciful. It's not rooted in anything historical. What's interesting is that there is actually a papyrus manuscript, papyri to the rescue, yeah, as per usual. And I printed this for you in full, so you've got it, you go home and read it and meditate on it and rejoice in it, etc. There is this manuscript which talks about, now this is admittedly from Egypt, but it talks about during the enrollment by the household, that it was necessary to notify all who for any cause soever are outside their nome. Nome is just Egypt, you know, is divided into 42 or so nomes, the Oxyrrhynchite nome or whatever it might be. Return to their nome, that is their original place, the domestic hearths, a family plot, that they may also accomplish this customary dispensation of enrollment. This is the register. And continue steadfastly in the husbandry. But this is an older translation. I should have retranslated it. But this is papyrological evidence of this happening in the period. This is very late first century, or maybe it's 104 AD of this practice happening. This isn't to say that this definitely then proves the Bible or anything like that. I mean, you can't extrapolate out from this to that. But all I'm saying is that this is on the same trajectory, shows a practice of returning to one's homeland as a common motif in the Greco-Roman world. It's not just something to get Jesus back to Bethlehem, so with connection to David. I think there's evidence that would suggest that this has been done. Aside from that,
well, I guess what we have to assume is that somewhere in the recent family of Joseph, they were still, you know, they had lived there within the last couple of generations,
yep,
or something.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Went to their own town in 2:3, and let me just mention one other thing, or a couple of other things, and then I have to wrap it up. I'll get to it in a moment. Okay, so yeah, chapter 2, verse 4, Joseph gets up, goes to Judea. Why would he go up to Judea?
Jerusalem.
Yes, Jerusalem. You always go up to Jerusalem. Even if you're going down to Jerusalem, you always go up to Jerusalem. It's like when in England, if you ever go, people always talk about coming up to Oxford. Come up to Oxford. Oxford is in a valley, and it's also south of many other places in England. That's not the right, the south. But you always go up to Oxford. You go down to Cambridge, don't you? No. Go up to Cambridge, too. But you always go up to Jerusalem, of course. So they go up to Jerusalem, to Judea, sorry. Bethlehem, the town of David, a house of bread, obviously. All this stuff in my notes about where Bethlehem's located. This is completely irrelevant for us here in Jerusalem, because you throw a rock and you'd almost hit Bethlehem if you've got a good arm. Wrapped in clothes, in a manger. Think of this for a minute. I'm overwhelmed by this every Christmas time. The humility of this. A manger. What is a manger? It's a trough. I used to go out to my grandparents' farm and we had to feed the pigs. Not a very Jewish thing to do, I guess, is it? But anyway, we had to feed the pigs. And that trough and those animals, not just pigs, but cattle and goats and sheep and whatever else with the hay, that thing stunk. It really stunk. Sometimes I would be dry reaching. There would be such stench. This is the place, the throne on which Jesus, the Messiah, God's entry into the world occurs.
It is the sign.
Sorry?
And it's the sign.
Yeah, exactly. It's just phenomenal humility.
It's
profound.
In Matthew, the sign is the star.
Yeah.
Right, Lucas. Damn.
Yeah. The trough. The stinky trough. We can talk more about the Kapalima and the Bandakheon, the inn. It's not a hotel that they go to. It's probably one of their relatives' house. There's no room there. And if everyone's returning for the census, maybe there's more people in town. So they have to...
It was actually one of the Sukkot. It's the Regalim. Everybody's there to get up to Jerusalem.
Yep. Then you have, beyond that, without spending too much time on this, the annunciation to the shepherds, and the reference to angels in verses 8 to 20. Jesus presented in the temple in 2:21-40. What's going on with this their purification in chapter 2, verse 22? Who has to be purified in Leviticus?
Mary.
Yet you have a reference, this puzzling reference to their purification. Purification in Leviticus 12, verse 6 is just for the mum, not the husband or the child. And you actually have some variants here. Let me show you this. You've got their purification in most of the manuscripts, and this is reflected in the English versions RSV, NRSV, ESV, NASB, NIV, NAB, blah, blah, blah. You've got his purification in the Syriac tradition and me. So his being Jesus, I guess. Unless it's Joseph, but no, his would be Jesus. Unless he helped with the birth. Maybe he was defiled by... there's no English versions of take that, not surprisingly. The purification, so that's actually the today's New International Version takes that. Only supported by the Coptic tradition, Majuscule 435, and her purification, which is actually King James and the New King James and the marginal readings in the NJ's New Jerusalem Bible and the New English, the NET translation.
Well,
so,
what does the NG mean? Because
marginal.
Marginal.
Yeah, so in the
footnote. The main translation has the.
Yes, has that reading, and then the NG is the marginal reading. So this caused some problems, obviously, for scribes.
Their purification must be the right reading. It's the woman who has to be purified, and we still have it now.
Well, that would make sense according to Leviticus, but then you could say, well, if that is the most problematic reading, then that's maybe more weight than it was originally their purification, and a scribe that knew his Old Testament said, well, it can't be their purification, it has to be her purification. Because that makes sense according to... So there's scribal motivation to change it. There's not much scribal motivation to change it from her purification, aftis, to afton. Because that would be introducing a problematic element to the text. But even if you take their purification, it's, at the end of the day, it's not that problematic. It just might mean that...
you could say the her in Leviticus includes... baby as well.
Okay.
Focusing on her because she's going to bring the sacrifice.
Yeah.
Because we know in other things that they're dealing with blood impurities that it's contagious.
Yeah.
Anyone who touches it will be impure. So obviously the child born
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, that's...
That would be, you could see it as kind of...
Sort of a family affair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Included even though it's not specifically stated.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is this Sinaiticus again here?
Did you try the Aleph?
No, right here on your handout.
Oh, yeah, so this is my next slide.
Oh, sorry.
You can't see it there, but yes, that's a Sinaiticus, mid-4th century. Katharismu Afton. Their purification. Let me just mention two final points, and then we have to wrap it up, sorry. This is so important, we can't not mention this. What do they sacrifice in 2:24?
Pigeons.
Leviticus 12:8 stipulates what?
If you're poor, you can bring pigeons.
Exactly. A normal person brings a lamb and a pigeon or a dove in 12:6. Or two doves or two pigeons if you're poor. One thing we know for sure, Jesus was born into a poor family. And this speaks volumes, I think, against this prosperity gospel that has infected the church, that God riches are a sign of blessing. Yes, of course, God does bless with material wealth. But in my own life, I would say that the richest blessing of all is human beings, are the relationships that God has blessed me with, and likewise. So, just an interesting little side note, and you could easily miss that if you didn't know your Leviticus, and not you don't normally read it in that context. And then we've got the presentation in the temple. So let me sum up by saying this. In contrast to the Hallmark approach to Christmas, where it's love, joy, and peace, I think Christmas is more about it's to do with pregnancy out of wedlock. It's to do with social stigma. It's to do with fear, embarrassment, unknowing, mystery. And the element of hope is that maybe in all that mess, God somehow might be able to weave together those chaotic, embarrassing, unlikely, fearful events into something which is beautiful and redemptive. And that, I think, in essence, is the Christmas story. And that's what I think Luke is speaking to in his presentation. And there's, of course, so much more that we could explore there. I'm sorry it's been a bit of a quick hot step through, but try to pick out some of the important elements. Great. Thank you. Sorry we ran over a little bit.
Thank you very much.